I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome to another episode of On Delmarva. We're about to have a conversation with William Dudley. Bill Dudley wrote the book Maritime Maryland, A History, an amazing book. He was served in the U.S. Navy. He's a historian. He worked for 20-odd years for the Naval Historical Center in D.C., where he was ended as its director in 2004. And written numerous books. This is one of them, and he joins us now to give us a little bit of taste of our history. Welcome, Bill. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here. Now that I'm living on the Eastern Shore, we just moved to Easton from Anne Arundel County a couple of months ago, and I'm finding it to be a fascinating place. We, of course, had thought about the move for a while, but it took 10 years for us to do it. I've sailed up and down the bay. I've put into Eastern Shore ports, St. Michael's, Oxford, Chestertown, places like that. So it's a pleasure to be here and see it from the inside out.
And it's a pleasure to have you in the studio. It's interesting to me that it's, you know, I told you before we went started this conversation, I looked at the book and went, oh, it's a coffee table book. But and you pick it up. This is not a coffee table book. This is a really thorough history of our maritime history in the state.
Yeah, thank you very much for pointing that out. I wasn't sure how it was going to turn out myself, but I knew what I wanted to do. I'd been thinking about this book for years, perhaps 15 or more years. While I had a day job, I really didn't have time to write much of the book, but I did have a lot of time to think about it. And a part of what brought me to the book was the sailing adventures I'd had. For many years, I've done a cruise every year for about a week. And I've gone to specific places. I've gone as far north as Havre de Grace, Sassafras River, and on down as far south as Smith Island on the Maryland side. And so it's given me a great inspiration to, you know, find out, you know, what goes on here on the Eastern Shore, on the bay itself. It put me in love with nature, the extent of the bay, the beauty of the bay. Those are the kinds of things that got me motivated to write this book.
One of the things that, as you were talking just then, made me think of the opening of the book where you talk about Captain John Smith in the early days in the bay and painting this picture of what the bay was like.
Yeah, the early days at that moment in time. We're talking about 1607, 1608, so far ago that people really can't imagine what it was like now. But if they read some of what he wrote and some of the early other settlers at the time, this was a place of magnificent riches in terms of the sea creatures, the wildfowl of the Chesapeake. The sky darkens when the ducks and the geese fly. Fish are so abundant you can practically scoop them into your canoe. And what they didn't know.
Oyster beds out of the water.
Yes, rising oyster beds out of the water and then running aground on them in unexpected places because what they literally, the oysters were so prolific that they call them oyster shoals or reefs in those days, as if it were a coral reef, for example, in the Caribbean. But so prominent, and from those days on until I think the late 19th century, that was the case. And then the industrial age caught up with the search for seafood, and basically we began to tear down those oyster reefs.
It's also when you go back to the beginning of the European exploration of the Chesapeake Bay with Captain John Smith and the it was what I found interesting too. I never thought about it until I was reading your book was how we actually learned from the mistakes of Jamestown, as you wrote about in the book, for the way he began to explore this region. He did it in a very different way.
Well, he took his shallop, which manned by about a dozen men, and he sailed for some 3,000 miles, basically going in and out of the rivers all up and down the bay in one summer, 1607-08, and it was a revelation to him. And, of course, some of the people who came over with him had dreamed of finding a Northwest Passage to India. My own personal view on reading some of his accounts is that he was quickly disabused of any idea that the rivers that came into the Chesapeake from the west were going to take him anywhere because they weren't big enough. He took the Potomac up as far as he could. He went into the Patapsco. He didn't really look into the Severn River. He explored the Nanticoke. He explored several other rivers, but he didn't really get to the point where he thought this was going to take him or anyone else up through this massive continent, which evidently went on for, you know, thousands of miles, but he didn't know the extent of it at the time. So at any rate, what he was doing was basically a voyage of discovery in a very small boat, with taking a lot of time, running into Indians, Native Americans of varying languages and cultures, discovering their ways of supporting themselves, their the way they fished, that they were farmers. And an interesting thing, on the western shore, there weren't that many settlements above, many Indian settlements above the Potomac. It was more or less an empty area where Indians would come down and they would farm, they would harvest seafood, and then go away. And sometimes they would leave artifacts behind, and that's led people to some conclusions about settlements. But it was a relatively open area, and on the western shore you find a lot of the rivers have English or Anglo names, whereas the rivers on the eastern shore have more Indian names.
Right.
And that is because the Indians had a name for them, and this was transferred to Smith and his cohorts and others as they came along. But it was from Jamestown and the Virginia colony that a lot of people came to people the upper Chesapeake when that time came. In the 1630s and 1640s and on, you find people coming up from Virginia, Norfolk area, up into the area where Annapolis is now on the Severn, and the new town of Providence was founded by people that came up from Virginia, basically because they weren't wanted in Virginia. They were Protestants who had objected to the Anglican Church in Virginia, and in the colony of Virginia. You were either Anglican or you were out.
That's why Maryland became this kind of bastion of Methodism.
Well, it's partly because of that.
Partially because of that, yeah.
Partially because of that, but also because the Calvert family, basically Catholic or the proto, they were secret Catholics until the James Stuart's regime
in England.
And then when James I approved, made a huge grant of land to Leonard Calvert, then it became very clear what he wanted to do was to create a refuge for Catholics, because the Catholics were there was an intolerance for Catholicism in England, and he thought maybe establishing a colony in the New World would give them a chance to enjoy their religion and prosper in a very new way. And so that was part of the reason for the founding of Maryland the way it was. The Protestants who were not Anglicans and the Methodists came later.
So this was Maryland. That's why Maryland did become a land of Methodists and Catholics.
Until 1688, 1689, right. The so-called Glorious Revolution occurred in England. This was a land of quite a bit of toleration. After that revolution came and the Stuart dynasty was removed from England, then it became a much more Protestant land.
Now, when we look at the history of the maritime history of this world we live in here, there are several parts stuck out. There's a naval history. There's a military history. There's a sailing seafood industry history. There's an agricultural history that you meld through this book.
Absolutely. What I tried to do here was to show the interactions of society and land and water. And it happened that in those early days, the roads were paths. There were no usual means of transporting goods or marching over land. It was much easier, much less expensive, and much quicker to travel by water. There were no bridges. You had to travel the long way around, but it was
or always, go across by water.
Go across by water.
Right.
If people wanted to go to the eastern shore, you either went from the western, you either went across by water, or you tramped around around the north way. So it was a time when everything that in terms of transport, in terms of warfare, in terms of harvesting the bay, it was done on the water. And the warfare is something that was with the colony and state of Maryland from early on. There was a Battle of the Severn in 1655. There was a Revolutionary War.
What was the Battle of the Severn? Why don't you, since you raised it, why don't you tell us very quickly what that is?
Well, the Battle of the Severn was actually a battle between the Catholics and the Protestants, and it took place in around the mouth of the Severn River, where the town of Providence had been established by some of the dissenters who had come up from Virginia, and the Calverts wanted to reestablish their control because what had happened in England was a civil war, and it had had an effect in Maryland as well. So the two sides are struggling in England and in the colony of Maryland, and the attempt to reestablish control over the Protestants in the area of Providence was unsuccessful. The Protestants won that little battle, which was waged both on sea and on land. And after that, there was an amnesty, and both the parties agreed that they would live together. But the Calvert family was definitely in control.
So we're coming back to naval history, because that is your – a lot of this book is about – not a lot, all of it, but a huge chunk is about naval history and the history of fought on the Chesapeake Bay, and you are – a Navy man and a historian. So, but let me ask you this question. I mean, so it's interesting to me because I never realized it until reading this book, the intensity of the wars, whether it was the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, the Civil War, that were fought on the water, that not necessarily these on land, as land wars.
Well, it's absolutely true. What we're talking about in terms of civil society was also true for the society when it went to war. You had to use the water. It was the quickest way of making your troop movements. It was the quickest way of getting your military goal achieved. Well, let me talk for a minute about the Revolutionary War. Revolutionary War, of course, was considered a madness by some people when it was considered that to build a continental navy in the Second Continental Congress, it was a question as to whether you could actually fight the British on water because they had such a huge navy.
Right.
And the United States at that time, or what was becoming the United States, had no navy at all. What happened first was that the states, the newly born states, were creating their own navies. Then the Congress said, we need a national navy. So on October 13, 1775, they began to form a national navy. A month later, they decided they needed Marines if they were going to have a navy. So November 10th is always the birthday of the Marines.
Marine Corps Day.
So here we are.
Jarhead Day.
Jarhead Day, and they celebrate it very, very well. Thank
yes, they
you
do.
Very much. At any rate, in Maryland, there was a navy which was not only commercial but military, and the reason was the British had established a blockade at the Chesapeake Capes, and there was, of course, no Chesapeake and Delaware Canal at the time, so that was the only way that the Marylanders could trade was to go up between Cape Charles and Cape Henry. The British knew that. They established a blockade off the Capes, and so if any supplies were going to come up the bay to Baltimore and perhaps in that same way up to Philadelphia overland, they had to come through the Capes. And at the same time, the British controlled the seas. So the British came into the bay several times And there was nothing much that Maryland or the very new American government could do about that. So Maryland decided to have a navy, and they built galleys. And Stephen Stewart, who lived on the western shore on West River, was an experienced boat builder at the time. He became their de facto navy yard on the West River. And he built galleys for the Maryland State Navy, and he helped them find competent people to sail those galleys. And ultimately, the British found out about this, and in 1781, they went up sent two ships up. They sent Marines in, and they burned Stephen Stewart's shipyard. The artifacts of that shipyard have been found by Bruce Thompson, who was the assistant underwater archaeologist of the state of Maryland at the time, and on the right near the property of Dean Hall, who was a friend of mine. He and his wife live on Lurch Creek, just above where that shipyard was located. At any rate, we found artifacts which are now, some of them are at a little Galesville museum. Some of them are at the Maryland Historical Trust.
Mm-hmm.
The report on all this is in the trust, and you can read about it there. At any rate, this was a part of the history of Maryland on the bay during the Revolutionary War. One of the exciting things that happened during those days, and I'm sure everybody was a little bit afraid in Maryland what was going to happen, is that the British came down after they won the Battle of Long Island, New York, in 1776. They decided they would capture Philadelphia to make it, because it was kind of the de facto capital of the Revolution. Well, they did, in fact, do that, but they didn't march over land. They came by sea. This immense British fleet, first of frigates, then of major warships, ships of the line, and then transports, came all the way down around Delmarva and in the Capes, and then sailed on up past Annapolis. They didn't stop. They went right to Head of Elk, right at the Elk River, at Elkton, is now, and then they offloaded and they marched all the way from that point up to just south of Philadelphia, and that's where they had the battles of Brandywine and the other battle I can't remember right now. At any rate, that was what happened, but to see this immense British fleet come up the bay made it very clear to a lot of people that this war could be lost right here. But frankly, it was the French who came in and rescued it. But it was also, I must add that Washington and Rochambeau, of course, marched their armies down from Connecticut down through New York, New Jersey, and then some of them stopped at Head of Elk, and the Maryland Navy and other vessels they had commandeered at the time brought those soldiers down to Annapolis, where they encamped before they marched all the way down to Yorktown. So that's part of the story.
The idea of a Maryland Navy, and that it actually did play a significant role.
Played a significant role
in the Revolution.
Absolutely. That I had to contend with is that down here on the eastern shore, especially lower eastern shore, there were those who were basically working with the British. Tories and those who helped the Tories found it to their advantage. The British would come in. They would want water. They would want cattle and wood for their to cook meals on board ship. They would use people who cooperated with them on the Eastern Shore. The Council of Safety in Annapolis was alarmed that this was going on. So they sent expeditions down to fight the Tories from the Eastern Shore in Tangier Sound and other places, even across the bay.
So where we're living was Tory land.
Yes, right. It was isolated, and who was going to predict what was going to happen when this fledgling United States is fighting this amazingly strong empire that the British had established? If you were placing a bet, which side would you be on in those days, especially if you're on the Eastern Shore and no significant aid was coming from Baltimore?
So very quickly, I want to get to the 1812 and the Civil War while we have time. I'm intrigued by both 1812. 1812, we're about to have the anniversary. It's popping up very soon.
Absolutely. The War of 1812 was a significant and it showed what could have happened during the Revolution. In other words, the Revolutionary War, the British didn't maraud over the eastern shore or the western shore up the rivers. In the War of 1812, they did exactly that. There was no significant naval presence in the bay in 1812. The troops had been sent north to what we would call today the Canadian border, and they were fighting up there. The ships of the Navy were fighting on the high seas. There were really only two vessels of the Navy in the Chesapeake at all, and a bunch of gunboats. Most of the gunboats were stationed either at Washington up the Potomac or down at Norfolk to protect Norfolk. Then there were the privateers, right? And the privateers were, in effect, a de facto Maryland Navy again. They didn't call them a Navy. They were the privateers from Baltimore, and they were out to make a patriotic dollar, and they did. They were very successful at that. Many of the privateers were built either on the eastern shore or by eastern shore boat builders who traveled to Baltimore and set themselves up in Fells Point and became the labor force, basically, that built those privateers because they knew how to make a fast quick tacking vessel that could easily outmaneuver a heavy British warship. So that was what the Maryland and the Baltimore's basic contribution to the War of 1812 was, that particular armed force at sea. And so you can be very proud of the fact that many people from Dorchester, Talbot, Kent, and so forth, the other counties here, took part in that, helped create that Navy.
Now, one of the interesting things is you talked about the Civil War in your book was some of the characters that you wrote about in the book, who were Confederate sailors.
Oh, indeed. There were several. Franklin Buchanan was a captain in the United States Navy. He lived at Y House in Princess Anne County. He was married into the Lloyd family. There was George Hollins, who came from Baltimore as a very young man. He fought in the War of 1812, but he switched sides. He switched sides in 1861 when the war began because he believed in states' rights and secession and slavery, and so did Buchanan. And, you know, even though they both spent almost a lifetime in the United States Navy, they went south. Isaac Mayo is another one. He's not from the Eastern Shore. He's from
Western Shore.
He's from the Western Shore,
right.
But he's from the Mayo, what is now called Mayo Peninsula,
right,
on the South River near Londontown. And he was of the same ilk. He had, as a very young midshipman, he'd fought in the War of 1812. So here are these guys. They've been in the Navy for almost 50 years, and they decide, no, it's a matter of conscience, I'm going to go south. Well, I think we're very lucky that only one-third of the Navy went south and not two-thirds, for example. But anyway, they were very committed to once the die was cast.
But a lot of that one-third came from here.
It came not just from Eastern Shore.
No, but I mean this.
Some of the leaders did. I won't say that many actual sailors were from Maryland. I haven't even been able to mm-hmm. assess that, but the officer corps, many of the officer corps did,
and a lot of this battle was fought on the bay itself. I mean, there were these skirmishes all up and down the bay during the Civil War.
Mostly skirmishes. Well, let me point out that there was a major battle fought in Hampton Roads, and that was the what we used to call a monitor in the Merrimack, but of course it was the USS Monitor, and it was the Virginia, the Merrimack, which had been burned and then rebuilt. Of course, the CSF Virginia Monitor fought a battle for control of the Southern Bay. Fortunately for the North, the Monitor came out pretty well in that, and it was a stalemate. But beyond that, the Merrimack in Virginia was destroyed by the Confederates themselves once McClellan's army came down the peninsula and that is in 1862. So from that point on, the U.S. Navy dominated the bay, but still there were guerrilla raids by Confederates working in small boats.
So let's talk a bit about the another piece of this, the bay and Chesapeake Bay. And I was really fascinated by your history of the oyster industry and the watermen and the creation of that culture and the creation of that world in the 1830s and 40s and how it kind of erupted back then. And
well, of course, and you know, it's the interesting thing to me is, of course, they'd been the watermen had been working in the Chesapeake for centuries. Okay, whether first it was the Native Americans, and then came the settlers from England and so forth. But in the early 19th century, the ability to preserve, to can oysters became a mass market thing, and industrialization of sea harvesting became a very strong engine toward extracting the the wealth of the bay, that is the fisheries of the bay, and making them more available to other people in the United States. But the people who've pioneered in doing that in terms of canning oysters and so forth, and also in terms of using dredges, many of them came from the Northeast. Many of them came from Connecticut, Long Island Sound. And when they had worked out the depleted the beds in the north, then they came down to the Chesapeake and basically began to do the same thing in the Chesapeake, and other people copied them because this is the way. These are the methods you use to harvest this very important seafood product. So gradually it became a fact that Baltimore was the center of this activity and started exporting preserved oysters, canned oysters, throughout the country through the rail network that grew up after the 1840s.
And in the 1840s, you write about the industry beginning in Baltimore with the beginning of the canning industry and selling it in a large way. I'm curious, just as a historian, what when you look at the world today we have, and on two levels. One, you can see just from the watermen you meet and know that where the culture of independence comes from, that when you look at that just historically. And the other part historically is I'm curious what you then would think about also the what that history you've written about the oysterman tell you about where we are today. But start with the culture, because it really is very unique.
Well, the culture of the waterman basically is that you are basically working alone. You're in your vessel. You're whatever it happens to be, a bug eye, a brogan, a bug eye, a skipjack, or a dead rise workboat. You are working with a few mates, a few people you've got on your boat, and you have to go out every day to make this living. And if you don't do it, no one's going to do it for you. So basically, you go out there. You don't like to be told what to do or where to fish or how many bushels of oysters to haul out in any given day. But in point of fact, after the 1880s, the oyster harvest began to diminish because there were so many oystermen out there tonguing, dredging, I think they were taking 15 million bushels of oysters a year from the bay in about 1885. But around 1900, the amount began to diminish, and it became so alarming that the government in Annapolis established an oyster commission to investigate the facts and to try to figure out why it is that this is happening. Well, overfishing. At that point, the diseases we talk about today were not known, but it was overfishing that was the thing. So basically, from a regime of being a very independent harvesters of the Chesapeake, gradually over time, regulations were put in place, and that you can only work your dredges so many times a week, and you can't use power and so forth. This is the this is the culture they're working in. But now, for example, if you want to talk about the present, watermen who used to be oystermen became crabbers in the 1920s when the oysters began to diminish. They also put in time fishing for the finfish. But the fish have diminished. Many of the species have been diminished by the millions, down to the point where they can hardly be harvested at all, and they have to find work ashore to tide them over when the fisheries aren't producing. So you've gone from a time when abundance was the key thing, and there didn't seem to be any end to it, to a time when we are beginning to see that there is or could be an end to fishing that is wild fishing from the wild, and they may have to be depend on the farming of fish and oysters and crabs.
A historic anathema to many oystermen.
That's absolutely right, and I'm not advocating that this is
right,
the case, but I'm just saying that this is a concern. So that there are all sorts of efforts now are now being made, and really have been worked on since before World War II, of trying to bring back the abundance that we once had, whether you're doing it through farming or from experimentation in laboratories, marine biological laboratories. The Sea Grant people from the University of Maryland have been working on this. There are many different efforts, not only in Maryland but in Virginia as well, to try to bring back the produce of the bay to something like it was back in the, let us say, the 1970s or even the 1950s. But it's a very hard thing to do.
One of the things I enjoyed reading about in this history was the history of the beginning of the oyster police that became the predecessors to the maritime police we have today in the state, but the actual wars they fought with the oystermen and the oyster pirates, and they had an entire fleet almost of these fish.
It came to be.
Yeah.
It came to be that. After the oyster catch began to diminish, you found that tongers and dredgers began to have fights right on the wharf. I mean, there was shooting going on between the two, and the tongers were more or less historically along the shallow areas of the bay, whereas the dredgers stayed out in the middle. But as the oyster catch diminished, then there became a kind of competition between the two as to, you know, who owned what piece of land. And of course, they didn't own it, but there was an understanding. Well, the two sides became ferociously involved with each other. The shooting broke out. They had to create some. I mean, the Annapolis, for example, the government felt it had to control this in some way. So they established an oyster police. One of the men who was famous in establishing this was, I think it was Davidson, Hunter Davidson,
mm-hmm.
who had been formerly a Civil War veteran. He'd been a Confederate veteran specializing in mine warfare, and he was a Maryland man. So, okay, I've fought on the water and I've fought on land, and I think I can handle it. So they put him in charge. Well, it wasn't a very successful effort, and it took several years of building up the oyster police before they could actually make any impact at all, because the oystermen fought back, and there were people lost their lives. There were gunfire went both ways. And then there was another part of this. There was a struggle between Maryland and Virginia as to where exactly the border was between where Maryland oystermen were trying to crab in Virginia waters and vice versa. And they were starting to fight about that.
And if you look at it historically, I was reading that part of your book, that antipathy, again, remains in many ways and has this historic roots.
Well, it does indeed. I mean, not only on the Eastern Shore, but over on the Potomac, too.
Right.
Because, you know, the famous thing is that Maryland owns the water right up to the Virginia shore, owing to discussions between Maryland and Virginia way back in the 1780s, which were reinforced along the way. But still in all, the demand for the catch, the need for oysters, the need for these men to earn their own living, they get desperate. and this is what happens.
So I'm curious if you to kind of talk a bit about what this research and book did to you. I mean, where, as you finish this, because it really is an amazing. I mean, you kind of delve into all these nuances, and one day I'd like to have you back just to pick up specific stories that meant a lot to you in this book, to hear you regale us with some of those stories, but to just a sense of what this writing this book has done.
Well, just writing the book has made me intensely interested in the politics of oysters or the politics of seafood. It's made me very interested in how you protect the environment. It's brought me to a point where I agree with Tom Horton. We've got to do something about population.
Tom would like to hear that.
Yeah. reading his book, and, you know, that wonderful book about the Nanticoke, but also how do you control this almost inevitable crowding around the bay? The population is burgeoning around the city centers, but it's also coming down to the seacoast. It's the desire for waterfront property, water view property. And there have been many attempts made by the various states and localities to control this. But it's an almost an inevitable drive to get to the water. And what this results in is a control of waterfront properties, basically crowding out people like watermen from the use of the waterfront. Examples of this abound. For example, the marinas, which were once shared by watermen and their watercraft, have been crowded out of marinas because of the recreational boaters that are coming along. That seems to be the next trend for the use of the bay. Recreation,
which is how you end your book,
and it's pushing those who depend on the water for their livelihood away from the locations which is best for them, and making it much more expensive. So I'll use the word pauperization, which may apply better in some locations than others. But watermen feel they're being pushed away from the best places to keep their boats and where they can do their harvesting and so forth. So it's just another form of what industrialization has done to the bay. So basically, I'm going to try to summarize. If there is no one villain here, mm-hmm. it's us.
As Pogo said that, didn't he?
Yeah.
In the comics.
We have met the enemy, and they
enemy
are
is us.
That's exactly right. That's from his coverage of the War of 1812, I may say. But it's a time for us to step back and look at what we can do as a people to help the bay restore itself. It is a legend, and people talk about rural legends or urban legends. This is just a plain old legend that the bay is so big that the action of the rivers and the sea and the tides, this will solve itself. You don't have to worry much about it. This is no longer the case, if it ever was the case. But industrialization has brought population. Populations bring abuse of the waterways as sewers, as ways of getting rid of industrial wastewater, some of which is too hot for sea life to live in. And it is also true that small towns and municipalities have not lived up to the fact of controlling the sanitary, the sanitary waste from their populations, and so some of it is not taken care of in the proper way, and it gets into the streams and creeks. We're poisoning the bay, so we have to step back and say, what it is that we can do to help the bay restore itself.
This has been really a pleasure, and I do hope you'll come back. We've just touched the surface of what you can tell us and teach us, I think, Bill Dudley. And I love your book, and it was a pleasure meeting you.
Well, thank you so much, Mark. It's been a pleasure to come here and begin to talk about some of these.
Just the beginning.
Some of these great stories that are in the bay and represented in the book. The book is really aimed at what it's aimed at is creating a synthesis of all the things that have been written about the bay over many, many years. And I thought that what I could accomplish here was to bring together these many studies in a narrative that is easily read, is gracefully written and is well illustrated. And I think that Johns Hopkins University Press has done a terrific job in producing this. It's a beautiful book, far beyond whatever I thought I could accomplish. So I'm grateful to them and also to the Maryland Historical Society and Chesapeake Bay Maritime Museum, which assisted in the publication of this book. Many of the illustrations are from those two right. institutions. So they believed in it, and I am very grateful, and thank you for the time to talk a little bit about
it. I appreciate it as well. William S. Dudley, Maritime Maryland, The History. Bill, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to On Delmarva on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and we'll be right back. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. This is Mark Steiner. Welcome back to On Delmarva. We're going to have a conversation with On Delmarva's correspondent, who you hear every week, environmental writer and thinker and doer and activist and outdoorsman. All that wrapped into one in Tom Horton. Tom, good to talk to you on air.
Good to talk to you.
So it's interesting to look at this world we're in now where everybody's cutting budgets right and left, and things trickle down from the federal government to the state to our local governments all over the state, all over the shore. Everybody's tightening belts. Rumors about EPA cutting back, major figures leaving that organization as well.
And life as we know it is ending. Seems like we're always saying that. It may actually be happening.
Well, let's think for a minute what would happen if all federal subsidies washed away, or most of them, and we were left with the struggle to save the land, save the bay. What would we do?
You know, and not just federal subsidies. And like a lot of big fundamental changes, Mark, if you imagine all of this stuff happened tomorrow night, of course it would be a disaster, and that's often how these things get painted. But, you know, if you imagine someone saying now over the next few years to several years, we're going to move in that direction, whenever we legislate, we're going to legislate with an eye to cutting subsidies and doing things on the cheap, then I think it can work fine. So you gotta keep that in mind. But you know, just one example that my goodness is one of the few things I applauded Ronald Reagan for. He tried to cut out the egregious 75% federal subsidy to help beach towns pump up sand on their beaches. Reagan was right. He said, "Hey, their beaches. They say they're the golden goose economically. If they're so good, maybe they should try paying the real bill." And you know, he got steamrolled just like everybody else by the beach people. But it's still a good idea. You know, why if Ocean City, Rehoboth, Bethany, Lewis are so wonderful economically, and I think they are at some level of development, but why should taxpayers across America pay, as they do virtually every winter after these nor'easters, millions of dollars to put the beach back? I think you would see more sensible development down there, and maybe Worcester County would have to stop having the lowest property tax in the state. I don't know if they actually had to pay for, you know, their own beaches. That's one example, which we'll both get shot for tomorrow. But
let me sit with that example for a minute, and then we'll come back to some more examples you might think about across our peninsula here. But What do you think would literally happen if the subsidies to replenish the beaches along the Delmarva coast were to end? What do you
think? I think they would look much, much more soberly at the idea of continuing to build upward you know, up and down the beach. I think they'd have to take a whole different, more sober reassessment of growth down there. I think they probably have to soak would-be developers but could deal more money, maybe raise some tax rates. Maybe they would even have to do what I believe some other states like North Carolina have done, adopt a sort of a rolling zone. Beach erosion is going to occur, and over time we're going to set development back from the beaches. Now, Ocean City, that's not much of an option because you've got a little strip of sand there. But I think they might. I think over the long term, you might see a degrowth in Ocean City. I don't think it would mean the place would go away, but they might have to make some hard decisions. And again, if you started that tomorrow night, whole hog, it would be a disaster, and I wouldn't recommend it. But if people there knew that, you know, over the next X number of years, this money, this treat's going to be on you, on the state, on the counties, the taxpayers of Maryland, as opposed to the federal taxpayers, then I think it would make for much saner view of development down there.
It's interesting. As you were speaking, I was imagining what it would be like at the ocean and seaside towns if over the next 10, 15 years they stop replenishing the beaches. It would really change the nature of those places completely.
Well, it would. It would lead to what's been called the New Jerseyization of the beach up in Jersey, where I believe either the money's been shorter or the erosion's been worse, or maybe both. You have some towns that were former beach towns, and now they have a big concrete wall there and the waves crashing against it, which that in itself causes problems as the ocean digs out under the wall all the force of that water. But you could end up with something like that. You know, while we're on huge federal subsidies for trying to stop the ocean, let's not forget wallops down on the Virginia part of the peninsula. You know, they spend a fortune every year hauling in, you know, house-sized boulders because they have decided to put rocket launching ramps right next to the beach, and it keeps wanting to move. So that's a big source of federal money too, and perhaps it would make more sense to move the facilities back rather than fight the ocean. But as long as the taxpayers are willing to pay, then no problem.
So let's think of some other scenarios. Take us drive us in from the ocean towards.
Okay. Here's a no brainer. You know, all of us are very proud of the programs like Program Open Space, which
right.
Raises hundreds of millions of dollars to protect land, where many of us contribute to groups like the Nature Conservancy that specialize in buying up land and getting easements on farmland to protect nature. You know, what if we stop zoning so badly in virtually every county on Delmarva? A few like Kent, Caroline, maybe a little better than others, Worcester, but by and large, the zoning just says, come on, sprawl development, eat up all the farmland. It's horrible zoning. Because we zone so badly, we then turn our pockets inside out, spending hundreds of millions, many years, trying to protect that land from development. What if, talk about a way to do things cheaper, what if we just had sensible zoning that said, this is farmland, this is countryside, this is not where we want the homes on 2 and 3 acre lots. Again, if you change the rules tomorrow night, could be a big problem. If you change it, just signaled that the rules are going to change, I think people could adapt with no problem. You know, we'd still build homes. Build them all over creation, and we could save a lot of money like that. I mean, all this money we spend, we become proud of spending it. We don't realize we spend it to offset terrible zoning. And the state, Mark, has a lot more authority over what the locals do zoning wise than most people think. They just do not choose to exert it. And hand, they subsidize the sprawl by providing money for schools when a county has grown out where it probably shouldn't have grown, you know, dumb growth as opposed to smart growth. And you may be aware, we just had a report saying 13 years after Maryland became nationally known for smart growth, putting growth around existing centers and keeping it out of the countryside, this report said it ain't working 13 years later. So because of that, we pay hundreds of billions a year to protect land for development. And right now, that's the only game in town, but I'm not sure we need to do that. Well, let's just assume, Mark, that Delmarva everywhere, we had to save the bay, and we didn't have a lot of money, which seems to be the case.
Now,
I think there's a couple things you'd do. I think you would really go back and get zealous about what we all pay lip service to is the polluter pays. If we're very worried about stormwater runoff, well, if you're going to do a lot of paving, maybe you ought to pay enough for that privilege that you think twice about it and you decide you didn't have to do as much paving. That would be polluter pays. Also, the poultry companies, you know, this has been a long-running debate whether they should take responsibility for poultry manure.
Right.
And I think we just go through the budget and look at every way we subsidize growth and other activities that we then have to pick the public pocket to offset their environmental impact.
Tom, it's interesting. I all these years I've known you. Never thought I would have a conversation where I'm hearing almost...
I'm talking like a Republican.
You're talking Tom Horton, kind of a libertarian analysis of how we can minimize government and save the environment.
Well, it would. There's a lot of common territory. You know, a lot of the things I'm talking about you can find in Obama's recent bipartisan committee on how to cut the deficit by several trillion dollars. And I think that there's a lot of overlap between deficit cutting and environmental protection. Why should we subsidize million-dollar homes with a mortgage deduction and then a second home on top of that? That's a very clear subsidy to sprawl. And again, can't phase it out overnight. Maybe you don't phase it out for lower-income people. But if you look at countries like England and Japan that do not subsidize mortgages, they have about the same rate of home ownership. Tends to be smaller homes, tends not to be McMansions on three-acre lots sprawling all over the countryside. So, yeah, I'm getting conservative in my old age.
Well, no, I don't know if it's so much conservative as it's... I think it's just interesting, really interesting food
Well, they do call it conservation, Mark.
That's right.
Conservation is conservative. There is a lot of overlap. You don't have to be a fan of big government to save the environment. I would love to see a day-long forum on Delmarva or for the state on how can we save the bay on the cheap.
I love it. I think you've started a great new conversation, and I deeply appreciate Tom Horton. Once again, all your work you do for the folks of the state and here on Delmarva. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.